Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Welcome, history friends, patrons all, to 1956, episode 2.11. Last time we saw how the lumbering march towards war continued, and we watched how the intervention of Israel into the equation changed things up a bit, you might say. Now that we're into October, some of the most infamous aspects of this story will come to light. For those unaware, the Suez Crisis provides one of the most startling instances of what can happen when sources become declassified. 40 years after the events I'll be talking about in this episode, the Sèvres Protocol will be made available to the public. After years of denial and blustering, this Sèvres Protocol contained irrefutable proof that the Prime Minister of Britain, alongside French and Israeli allies, signed on the dotted line to conspire against Egypt in the name of protecting the Suez Canal. It makes for incredible reading and listening. You might even say incredulous reading and listening, but in this episode we're going to see several threads of the story come together, until they converge on a little-known Parisian suburb where one of the most incredible deals of the Cold War was made. Without any further ado then, it's time to begin this story, which begins, of all places, on the 5th of October 1956 at the United Nations Security Council in New York. Selwyn Lloyd and his French counterpart Christian Pinault sat at the horseshoe-shaped table of the UN Security Council. The order of the day on the 5th of October 1956 was to find a peaceful solution to the current crisis underway in Suez. Lloyd was made aware of the fact that, as he and his French peer sat in New York, back home in London, Anthony Eden, the Prime Minister, had collapsed with a high fever. The serious strain of the job had apparently culminated after the Prime Minister had received yet another refusal from John Foster Dulles to approve of a strike against the Egyptians. Eden had recently returned home from Paris in late September after a meeting with the French to ensure that the Anglo-French Entente was still in play. Now the saga was continuing in the UN Security Council, and Eden had to rely on Selwyn Lloyd to represent Britain on this important stage. The gut feeling among Eden and Lloyd had been that the French were drifting away. In actual fact, they were merely drifting closer towards the Israelis, without sharing with the British exactly what they were planning, and this seems to have been detected. With the French apparently shifty as military plans were entering their final stages, and the Americans once again non-committal, Eden fired the negative reply across the desk at Anthony Nutting, the Parliamentary Under-Secretary of State at the Foreign Office. In all of his dealings with Anthony Eden, Anthony Nutting appears to have taken some kind of record, which he eventually published in his incendiary memoirs in 1967. Before the great release of classified documents in the 1980s, Nutting's account of his dealings with the Prime Minister and his insistence that collusion and conspiracy were commonplace in Eden's government were perhaps the evidence used by British historians in their assertions that when it came to the Suez Crisis, all was not as straightforward as it seemed. Knowing what we know now, with full access to the source material and the communications between the relevant British departments in 1956, the scale of Eden's quest to remove Nasser by any means necessary becomes stunningly clear. It was a picture which was first sketched by Nutting, who resigned in protest at the Suez debacle, but this picture was properly painted and coloured with the release of declassified documents, which of course vindicated Anthony Nutting to a great extent, and also silenced those who had accused Anthony Nutting previously of peddling some kind of conspiracy. On the 1st of October, in his final meeting with Eden before the Prime Minister's health deteriorated, Nutting recalled the scene where Eden received news from Washington to the effect that once again, the Americans would not support any armed intervention in Egypt undertaken by the British. Nutting remembered. Eden read the Dulles statement quickly, and then, with a contemptuous gesture, he flung the piece of paper at me across the table, hissing as he did so. "And now what have you got to say for your American friends?" he asked. I had no answer, for I knew instinctively that this was for Eden the final letdown. We had reached breaking point. Breaking point, indeed, for Eden would be laid low owing to the immense strain of this disappointment only a few days later. But back to the UN Security Council, and even while his master was recuperating in hospital, Selwyn Lloyd was discovering something interesting. Now that Eden wasn't sending him regular advice on a drip, he found that he was actually enjoying the exercise of representing Britain with his own mind. There was much to discuss and a great deal of content to get through. The powers assembled at the Security Council, which included the British, French, Americans and Soviets, included six other elected temporary Security Council members. The United Nations had a grand role to play in the Korean War, but in the Suez Crisis 3 years later, it would be cynically made use of by the Anglo-French as a kind of useful cloak rather than as a genuine peacemaking institution, as we will see. The 11 Security Council members were tasked with working through old conferences, like the ones which had been hosted in London in mid-August and in late September. Both of these put forward the idea that a board of international members should be elected to serve on an advisory board, which would in turn help the Egyptians run the Suez Canal. The Soviets denounced the idea as a capitalist plot in manipulative clothing, but Iraq's representative attempted to find some kind of compromise. Could the rights of the Egyptians not be recognized, in addition to a fair system of tolls with a reasonable share of the canal's revenue going to Cairo? The UN Secretary General, who presided over the debate, was Sweden's Dag Hammarskjöld, who took over from Trygve Lie, the Norwegian Secretary General, who had presided over the Security Council during the Korean War. Hammarskjöld was known as a fair negotiator and would be posthumously awarded the Nobel Peace Prize after his death following a plane crash in 1961. This Swede had his work more than cut out for him in autumn 1956, though, and he declared, "I will be acting merely as a chaperone," to which John Foster Dulles, who was also present representing the United States, retorted, "My understanding of a chaperone is a person whose job it is to keep two people apart. Your job is to get the parties together." Whether this confusion was a result of mistranslation or not, Hammarskjöld presided over a lively and constructive debate between the 9th to 11th of October. The debates were constructive largely because Selwyn Lloyd and Christian Pinault showed themselves willing to compromise, and because Lloyd in particular believed that the United Nations provided him with the best opportunity to gain satisfaction for Britain, after so many limply unsuccessful conferences and pressure campaigns. Lloyd had been approached by representatives from Saudi Arabia in particular, who informed the British Foreign Secretary that they had informed President Nasser in their own turn that they desired some kind of international board be set up, since this would dilute Nasser's ability to constrain the delivery of oil through the canal. Was Nasser thus willing to go along with the suggestion of the UN Security Council? Selwyn Lloyd believed that he might be if the draft resolution was presented correctly. The British Foreign Secretary seemed to be on the verge of a breakthrough when two stumbling blocks emerged. The first was that the French Foreign Minister, Christian Pinault, suddenly became less interested in the debate and sat out of important discussions, which delayed and frustrated efforts to reach a consensus. The second was that Anthony Eden, having recuperated for close to a week by the 11th of October, was back to his old ways of sending the weary Selwyn Lloyd advice on precisely what he should do. Under no circumstances, Eden informed Lloyd, should Britain be seen to agree to some kind of conciliatory proposal. The UN negotiations, in Eden's mind, were useful only insofar as they could prove that Britain had done all it could to preserve the peace before making war. The Prime Minister wanted the UN talks to fail, and he had this in common with the French. The reason why Christian Pinault became non-committal and difficult all of a sudden was because he had been instructed to torpedo the talks as well. Pinault's superior in Paris, Guy Mollet, had already brought the government over to the policy of teaching President Nasser a lesson. It wouldn't do if Pinault then returned home to Paris with a deal that allowed Nasser to hold on to his gains. From these two acts of sabotage, we can surmise that the Anglo-French intrigues prevented a peaceful settlement from coming to the fore. Working without the approval of the Soviets was one thing, but it was impossible for the UN Security Council to produce any draft resolution aimed at solving the Egyptian problem so long as the majority of its permanent members were opposed. Having been given their marching orders, Selwyn Lloyd and Christian Pinault withdrew behind closed doors and emerged to produce a proposal from the previous month which the Egyptians had already rejected. Everyone in the room became edgy, suspecting that some kind of fix was in, but at the same time, John Foster Dulles was not greatly surprised. He had noted as early as the 4th of October to the National Security Council that never before in recent years have we faced a situation where we have no clear idea of the intentions of our French and British allies. Allies, indeed, but the French and British foreign ministers were acting in what they believed was their national interests. The Americans had had their chance to get on side, but they had missed the boat. Selwyn Lloyd, for his part, was genuinely sickened by his master's decision. Unfortunately, Selwyn Lloyd simply did not hold strong enough convictions to carry the day. Far stronger was his sense of loyalty to the Premier, a quality in Tory ministers which first became all-important, with Churchill's assumption of the Premiership 15 years before. On the morning of Sunday the 14th of October, the day after the Anglo-French resolution, which nobody had expected to pass anyway, had been vetoed by the Soviets, Eden was content to write to Selwyn Lloyd to the effect that should not we and the French now approach the Egyptians and ask them whether they are prepared to meet and discuss in confidence with us on the basis of the second half of the resolution, which the Russians vetoed? If they say yes, then it is for consideration whether we and the French meet them somewhere, for example, Geneva. If they say no, then they will be in defiance of the view of 9 members of the Security Council and a new situation will arise.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number 1 in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
In Eden here was misinterpreting the recent episode. While technically a majority of the Security Council members supported the Anglo-French proposal, and that only a veto by the Soviets had put the kibosh on it, in reality these members had voted for the draft resolution due to a sense of fealty with the Anglo-French representatives, on the understanding that supporting them would result in further talks. The fact that only the Soviets had prevented the talks going further meant that the UN Security Council wanted more talks. It did not mean that they approved of the use of force. But Anthony Eden wasn't listening to this technicality. He was instead awaiting Selwyn Lloyd's return home after making a show of seeking peace. The Anglo-French military strike was as ready as it would ever be, but Eden knew that it still lacked a justifiable reason to actually involve itself in Egypt. Britain would look like a terrible aggressor if it invaded Egypt just after talks in the UN Security Council had failed. The question of what to do was solved by a situation created by several falling dominoes, and the first domino fell in an unlikely theatre, Jordan. The Anglo-Jordanian Defence Treaty called on Britain to act if Jordan was attacked, as all good defence treaties tend to do. Yet, when an Israeli border attack on the Jordanian village of Kalkalia left 100 Jordanians dead, and when Jordan's King Hussein protested to London to come to its aid, Anthony Eden did nothing. In desperation, did King Hussein of Jordan appeal to Israel's worst enemy, Egypt? Alarm bells went off instantly in Eden's cabinet. Until a solution was reached, Britain's key ally in the region, Iraq, would send in troops to pacify and defend Jordan and protect it from further Israeli encroachments. This, to Anthony Eden, made sense: protect one ally in the Middle East through the use of another. But the action seriously rankled the Israelis. David Ben-Gurion, the Israeli president, had long had his eye on Jordanian territory and consistently parroted the thesis that Jordan was too unstable to exist in the Middle East and should be parceled up between Iraq and Israel instead. Now that Iraqi forces were in place, settling the situation down, the Israeli leader regarded the incident as a flagrant attack on Israel's position, taken as usual by those lifelong agitators, the British and their Middle Eastern friends. Jordan could not be allowed to threaten Israel with an Egyptian alliance. Jordan and her Iraqi friends would have to stand down. But nobody stood down, and tensions began to boil. In his anger, did the Israeli leader determine that the time had come to pursue other deals. He would test the recently established French connection to get what he wanted. In the meantime, Eden's officials tried to pacify the Israelis by instructing the Iraqis to move back from the border with Israel, and also they sent fewer men into Jordan. Anthony Nutting, mindful as were many of his peers of the Franco-Israeli connections, but only of the arms deals and not of the full extent of the political arrangements, sent an urgent message to Eden to the effect that it seemed likely Israel was about to seize the west bank of the River Jordan. Yet David Ben-Gurion didn't want to parcel Jordan up, at least not yet. This incident had flared up beyond its original parameters, and now Israel felt threatened more by the Iraqi show of force than by anything else. If the Iraqis were moving soldiers into the sensitive region north of Israel, then Ben-Gurion could never feel confident ordering a strike against Egypt, the true target. Realizing that things were escalating, and that perhaps only he had the power to solve the crisis, who should step in but the French Premier, Guy Mollet? Guy Mollet knew full well that if he didn't come clean with the British about the French deals with Israel soon, then a proxy war completely aside from the strike against Egypt could well break out, distracting everyone's attentions as the spheres of influence in the Middle East of the British and French collided. This had the potential to pull apart the new Entente, and Mollet couldn't allow it. He was willing to take a risk, to come clean with the British about how far the Franco-Israeli agreements went, in the hope that this would bring London on side with Tel Aviv and Paris, and strengthen the Allied hand against Egypt. It sounded sensible enough in Mollet's mind, but the critical problem was how to get Anthony Eden on side when the Prime Minister had never been overtly fond of the idea of an Israeli partnership. Guy Mollet was thus banking on the fact that this time the British Prime Minister would agree to an Israeli partnership because he planned to sell this partnership as one which was aimed specifically at undoing President Nasser. On the 13th of October, Guy Mollet cabled Anthony Eden with the news that the following day, a French delegation would be arriving in the strictest secrecy to meet with him, with the Prime Minister that is, about an important new development. The meeting was to take place at Chequers, Eden's country residence. the tangled events of the Middle East over the 10th to the 13th of October were far from the first occasion that Israel had come up in British discussions. As early as the 28th of July, 2 days after the nationalisation of the Suez Canal, Israel had been nominated as a potential ally by a member of Antony Eden's cabinet, and it was nominated by a man who soon became Tel Aviv's most enthusiastic supporter, Harold Macmillan. Harold Macmillan was a former foreign secretary, holding the position for much of 1955, until Eden had unexpectedly replaced him with Selwyn Lloyd in December of that year. Macmillan had since been shunted off to the Treasury and was now Chancellor of the Exchequer, but he had never kept his eye off of foreign affairs. Militarily, it would be to our advantage if the Egyptian Armoured Division, now astride the canal, could be induced to move east of the canal. A demonstration by Israel might well achieve this, Macmillan said, 2 days after Nasser had shocked the world by assuming control of the Suez Canal Company. This was an idea which gained little to no support from Macmillan's peers, which is surprising considering what transpired later in the year. Throughout August 1956, Macmillan remained unable to convince his peers of the potential usefulness of some sort of Israeli partnership, even after he had picked the brains of Churchill, who was in favour of it in principle. Eden was at first appalled and then deeply irritated by Macmillan's schemes. "None of his business anyway," the Prime Minister opined, as if to say, "Stay in the Treasury office where you belong, Macmillan." If Macmillan took the hint publicly, then privately he rarely thought of anything else. While Eden fumbled along with his efforts to devise some kind of casus belli, Macmillan continued to confide to his closest peers that the crisis could be made to work in Britain's favour if she took advantage of Israel's intense hatred of the Egyptians. Macmillan supported the principle of war with Nasser, but he was as wary as Eden had been of plunging into the abyss without American support. "We should need all the help we could get, but we might have great difficulty because of possible American and other opposition," Macmillan said. The Permanent Secretary to the Treasury, Sir Edward Bridges, added that it was a vital necessity from the point of view of our currency and our economy of ensuring that we do not go it alone and that we have maximum US support. Macmillan noted in the margins of this observation that "this is just the trouble. The United States are being very difficult." Indeed, President Eisenhower could level the same charges at the British. They were the ones who seemed incapable of cooperating or compromising. It was at 3 p.m. on the 14th of October 1956 that Eden's mind would undergo a rapid, profound change where Israel was concerned. Antony Eden was waiting for the two French officials in his study, since, remember, in the name of secrecy, all had agreed to gather at Chequers, Eden's manor home. Antony, noting as our source for the meeting, as he was among only five other men to sit in this meeting between French and British officials, while the high point of conspiratorial scheming went underway. After seeing his overtures to the Americans rejected multiple times, and knowing that the UN Security Council would not help him, Eden was open to what the French would have to say, and he became very eager as the meeting went on to know exactly what it was that had brought them to his private home. Antony Nutting recalled that much of the initial conversation was taken up about the Iraqi situation, where the French seemed particularly insistent to have their own way, and in the name of their Israeli friend, to persuade the British to order the Iraqis out of Jordan. At this point in the negotiations, Antony Nutting, unaware of the bombshell which was to come from the French within the next few minutes, argued his point doggedly. "I jumped in at this point," Nutting recalled, adding that "we had already pushed Nouri, the Iraqi premier, far enough and persuaded him to station his troops in northeast Jordan to issue strict instructions that they were not to cross the west bank of the Jordan River or in any way present the smallest threat to Israel, and finally to send only a token force. We cannot now forbid him to move at all. After all, the idea of sending Iraqi troops to reinforce King Hussein of Jordan had sprung from us and not from Premier Nouri. But my arguments were in vain." For Eden, whose antennae had begun to sense that the French appeal might be the prelude to some further and more positive proposal for joint Anglo-French action, cut me short by saying that he would, at any rate, ask Premier Nouri to suspend his move temporarily. According to diplomatic protocol, now it was the turn of the French to offer some kind of concession in return for Eden's promise to delay the Iraqis. Nutting passed a note saying as much to Eden, which Eden simply set aside. He was all agog, in Nutting's words,
to see what the French had to say. One of the French delegates, Albert Gazier, who was the French Minister for Social Affairs back home, put forward a simple question to the Prime Minister. How would Britain react if Israel were to attack Egypt? The Frenchman asked. Eden must have been a bit disappointed in this grand French reveal. Nutting recalled that the Prime Minister noted the existence of the Tripartite Declaration, which committed Britain, France and the United States to defend any Middle Eastern state whose territory was attacked. Such an agreement was designed to keep the peace in light of the bitter and costly conflict a decade before, which had established Israel. Eden believed that this couldn't be violated. However, he was then hit with an ingenious bit of information, which had never even occurred to him. Gazier was able to quote President Nasser's public announcement, made several times since his assumption of the presidency, that this tripartite declaration did not apply to his regime. It applied to Egypt, according to its original terms, but since Nasser absolved himself of the responsibilities laid down within it, he also absolved himself of its protections. A smile would surely have spread across the Prime Minister's face, as Anthony Nutting recalled. "So that's us off the hook," Eden said excitedly. "We have no obligations, it seems, to stop the Israelis attacking the Egyptians. I thought for a moment of arguing the obvious point, that our obligations stemmed from the Tripartite Declaration itself, and that, whatever Egypt might say, this meant we had a peacekeeping role in the Middle East. But it seemed more important to find out what lay behind the French inquiry, so I asked Gazier what, if any, information he had that Israel were contemplating an attack on Egypt. It was then that the plan for an Anglo-French intervention into Egypt, under the cover of an Egyptian-Israeli war and with the excuses of securing peace and protecting the Suez Canal, was laid out before Anthony Nutting and the Prime Minister. The plan, as it was simply known at this stage, contained several variables and loose ends which would be discussed, it was said, at a later date, but Anthony Nutting's recollection of the plan as it stood on the 14th of October deserves in any case to be recounted. Nutting said, "France and Britain, having given the Israeli forces enough time to seize all or most of Sinai, should order both sides to withdraw their forces from the Suez Canal in order to permit an Anglo-French force to intervene and occupy the canal on the pretext of saving it from damage by fighting. Thus, the two powers would be able to claim to be separating the combatants and extinguishing a dangerous fire, while actually seizing control of the entire waterway and of its terminal ports, Port Said and Suez. This would not only restore the running of the canal to Anglo-French management, but by putting us physically in control of the terminal ports, a position which Egypt had always held, it would enable us to supervise all shipping movements through the canal, and so break the Egyptian blockade of Israel." 2 days later, Eden and Selwyn Lloyd were on their way to Paris to talk further with the French about the situation. Lloyd only returned from the United Nations in the afternoon of the 16th of October and had not been present at the small meeting of Eden's cabinet earlier in the day. Before the Israelis were properly brought into the discussion and the French scheme was developed, Eden wanted to know the extent of French military planning and cooperation with the Israelis in the Middle East. During this meeting between the Prime Minister, his Foreign Secretary and their French counterparts in the evening of the 16th of October, no minutes were kept, and even the British ambassador to France was excluded, to his fury. Guy Millay sent David Ben-Gurion a note only a few hours after the British had left, which likely summarised the meeting's most important points. The memo began, "In the event of any threat of hostilities in the neighbourhood of the canal, the French and British governments would call the belligerents to halt and to withdraw from the immediate vicinity of the canal. If both agreed, then no action would follow. If one or both refused, Anglo-French forces would intervene to ensure the free passage of the canal. In the event of hostilities developing between Egypt and Israel, Her Majesty's government would not come to the assistance of Egypt because Egypt was in breach of a Security Council resolution and had moreover repudiated Western aid under the Tripartite Declaration." The Israelis were thus brought on side, and were now on the same page as the British and the French, or were they? David Ben-Gurion seemed to be wholly opposed to the plan in principle. He didn't like the idea of the French or British intervening to keep the peace, which bold, naughty Israel, as the picture would have it then, had fractured. He also didn't trust the British as far as he could throw them, and he was averse to collaborating with anyone who didn't have Israel's interests close to heart. Ben-Gurion may have wondered why it wouldn't be necessary to simply leave Britain out of the equation, yet he had already been informed of the reason for British involvement. It would be impossible to achieve the kind of smooth plan they were aiming for without the cooperation of the British, specifically its air force. Eden would never have allowed such an operation to go ahead, and the French would never act to deliberately alienate their most useful ally in the West. Ben-Gurion, ever so gradually, thus came around to the plan. But first he put up several of his own demands, which included an Anglo-French commitment to destroy Egypt's air force, an assurance that Iraq would not get involved, and approval for Israeli territorial gains in Sinai, which would give her access to the Red Sea. Upon receiving these demands, Guy Mollet appreciated that the three would-be accomplices would have to meet in person to hammer these details out. Meanwhile, Anthony Eden was busy acquiring the approval of his cabinet, many of whom were only being brought on side to the situation in Egypt now, for the first time. We'll recall that up to this point, ever since Nasser had nationalised the canal company in late July, an Egyptian committee had been set up consisting of six of the government's most important figures. Harold Macmillan, Anthony Eden, Selwyn Lloyd, and three others thus had the lion's share of information come their way for the bulk of the crisis, and they made the bulk of the decisions under Eden's watchful gaze. This didn't stop some figures, like Anthony Nutting, who was standing in for Selwyn Lloyd as the latter was returning from the United Nations, from speaking out, or at least speaking in favour of a rational option while he sat on this committee. Nutting was the parliamentary undersecretary for the Foreign Office, and had always been opposed to the plan. Nutting recalled, "I was to represent the Foreign Secretary until he should arrive in person. Meanwhile, I was to consult only two senior Foreign Office officials. My suggestion that at least the Foreign Office legal adviser, Sir Gerald Fitzmaurice, should be brought in on a matter which involved taking the law into our own hands, met with the flattest of negatives." "Fitz is the last person I want consulted," Eden retorted. "The lawyers are always against our doing anything. For God's sake, keep them out of it. This is a political affair." We may remember Gerald Fitzmaurice from a few episodes ago, when he led the desperate charge to find some legal grounds for intervention against Egypt, only to conclude in the end that no genuine grounds existed. Other than Nutting's suggestion here, though, no voices were raised in opposition to what Eden had planned. Harold Macmillan was also in favour, and may even have had the look of "I told you so" about him, now that the Israelis were to be cooperated with after all. With the approval of cabinet and secrecy emphasised and maintained, Eden had the green light to achieve a great victory. The French continued to work on Israel, but on the 18th of October an incident occurred which compelled Guy Mollet's government to adopt an even more forceful stance and to clamour even more urgently for the plan to go ahead. A small enough military vessel bearing the flag of Sudan was intercepted by the French on its way from Alexandria to Algiers. On board was over 70 tons of arms and ammunition. There was no doubt that these supplies were destined for the Algerian rebels. Here then was conclusive proof that Nasser's regime was aiding and abetting the Frontier Liberation Nationale, or the independence movement of Algeria, and it caused uproar among the French populace and press, who agitated for some firm action to be taken against Cairo. Guy Mollet was feeling the pressure and began to gather the necessary figures around him. He planned to bring the Israelis and British together face to face at long last, to solve the outstanding issues and to bring the timetable of the plan forward post haste. His political career and the prestige of France depended upon the outcome of such swift action. Yet Mollet knew that he would have to maintain the most delicate levels of secrecy as he proceeded. The world would never buy the idea that the British and French were intervening in the name of peace if it could be proved that they had met with Israel before the war with Egypt began. Thus, after some logistical efforts, it was arranged that Selwyn Lloyd from Britain and David Ben-Gurion, accompanied by his foreign and defence ministers, would all travel to the Parisian suburb of Sèvres with the sole purpose of engaging in concrete negotiations foremost in everyone's mind. Next time, we'll resume our story in the midst of this incredible development, as the fix was plainly in and a protocol for war came to the fore. Until then, history friends and lovely patrons, my name is Zach, and this has been 1956 episode 2. 11. Thanks for listening, and I'll be seeing you all soon.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from LA. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more.
Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.